Welcome to A Katra Dialogue, a journey through timeless literature. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of A Katra AI. Hello, everyone, and welcome to the deep dive. Today, we're not just reading a book. We're really embarking on a journey into a literary landscape that's, well, it's foundational, but also fiercely debated.
Definitely.
We're talking about Joseph Conrad's Heart of Darkness. It's a novel that truly challenges your perceptions. You know, it pushes us way beyond just an adventure tale.
Right into the deep end.
Into the unsettling depths of psychological fiction. So our mission here in this deep dive is basically to unravel the whole storyline, trace those transformative, often harrowing journeys of the character.
And really get to grips with those powerful themes, sometimes terrifying themes.
Exactly, the ones it unearths.
And what an expedition it is. I mean, at its core, yeah, it describes a physical voyage, right, into the heart of Africa.
Mm-hmm.
But it morphs so quickly into this unsettling descent into what the narrator, Charlie Marlowe, he calls it the heart of human darkness.
Such a powerful phrase.
It is. And his story, this haunting tale he tells, starts quite peacefully, actually. On a yacht on the River Thames.
A world away.
Completely. But it takes us far, far from those familiar shores. And the big question Conrad poses, the one we really want to dig into today, is, well, it's profound. What actually happens when that comforting layer, that veneer of civilization, is just stripped away?
What's left underneath?
Yeah, what's exposed, that raw, maybe primal essence.
Okay, that's a powerful setup. So before we dive into Marlowe's actual journey, maybe let's unpack some context about the author himself, Joseph Conrad.
Right, Joseph Theodor Conrad Korsanowski.
Exactly, a Polish expatriate who became this, I mean, undisputed master of English prose. And it was his third language.
Incredible, isn't it?
It really is.
Yeah.
What strikes me is his background, a former merchant mariner, his own really harrowing journey in 1890 up the Congo River that directly inspired this novella.
Absolutely central.
So how do you see that personal history shaping his perspective? Especially, you know, bridging that Victorian optimism with a sort of dawning modernist disillusionment.
Oh, it's completely central to the novel's power. Conrad's firsthand experience on the Congo, it was like a crucible for him. It let him infuse Heart of Darkness with this authenticity, this visceral detail that, you know, pure imagination probably couldn't achieve.
He lived it.
He really did. He saw it. He felt it. Maybe he even endured those moral compromises, the absurdities of the whole colonial project, and that fundamentally questioned the moral certainties of his time.
Right.
So this personal immersion, it let him craft a narrative that doesn't just describe events. It really digs into the psychology of disintegration. His perspective truly bridges those eras, you know? Showing the cracks in that Victorian belief in progress and empire.
And sort of anticipating the skepticism of the 20th century.
Precisely. Now, initially, the reception was a bit mixed.
Oh, really?
Yeah. But eventually, it cemented its place as a masterpiece. Though it's important to say, not without ongoing controversy. Chinua Achebe's critique, for instance, about its portrayal of Africa and Africans, that's a really powerful and important part of the conversation around the book.
That's a crucial point, yeah. Its legacy and the debates it still sparks today. And structurally, how did this profound work actually get published?
Well, it first appeared as a three-part serial in Blackwood's magazine back in 1899.
Ah, serialized.
Yeah, before being published as a book in 1902. And this kind of debut, first serialized, then collected, it really highlights how it works as both, you know, a gripping adventure story and this deeply introspective psychological fiction.
Best of both worlds, in a way.
Or perhaps the most unsettling of both worlds. It acts as this vital literary link connecting those outward-looking, sometimes romanticized colonial stories of the 19th century with the 20th century's really intense, often unsettling explorations of human consciousness.
Mm.
So consider this an invitation, then, for you, the listener, to step into a narrative that, well, it promises to challenge maybe every assumption you hold about civilization, morality, even human nature itself.
Challenge accepted. Okay, let's begin the journey with Charlie Marlowe. What first draws into this blank space on the map, and what are his initial steps into that colonial world actually like?
Right. So the story really kicks off with Marlowe as a young man, just fascinated by maps. He looks at these blank spaces, specifically the Congo, that huge winding river, and sees it as this irresistible pull, a place of mystery, maybe adventure. But his entry into the Belgian Trading Company, it's not some grand romantic quest. No, he gets the job almost by chance, actually. The previous captain died in this rather mundane argument over some hens.
Hens.
Seriously.
Seriously. And I think that immediate detail, almost farcical, it subtly undercuts any sort of idealized ideas of heroic adventure he might have had.
Sets a certain tone.
It does. Then, even before he gets to Africa, he visits Brussels, which he calls quite eerily a whited sepulcher.
Right, that image. And there he has these really unsettling encounters. Two women knitting like the fates, you know, weaving destinies. And a doctor measuring skills, talking about the psychological changes that happen out there.
Creepy.
Deeply creepy. It's this ominous, almost gothic prelude. It really foreshadows the psychological toll that Africa, or maybe more accurately, the company, is going to take on him.
So it sounds like Conrad's already laying the groundwork, deconstructing any innocence even before the main journey starts. How do these early unsettling European encounters start shaping Marlowe's view? Does it hint at the hypocrisy to come?
Absolutely. These moments are pivotal. Marlowe, like probably many Europeans then, carried these sort of conventional ideas about European superiority, the noble civilizing mission.
Sorry, right? Standard narrative.
But Brussels starts chipping away at that immediately. That whited sepulcher image itself says so much looks clean outside, but inside, decay. He's already getting uneasy about what his job really entails, sensing this deep hypocrisy, a darkness hidden beneath the polished surface of European business. It forces us to ask, doesn't it? How often do we romanticize the unknown, project our ideals onto it, only to find these stark, unsettling realities waiting? Realities that maybe reveal uncomfortable truths about ourselves, too.
That is a sobering thought. And I guess that unease just ramps up once Marlowe actually reaches the African coast.
Yeah.
What's waiting for him at the company's outer station?
Oh, the contrast is just brutal. Marlowe's arrival at the outer station is shocking. He steps into the scene of complete chaos, despair, rusting machinery, pointless blasting going on, disease everywhere.
Just chaos.
Total chaos. He vividly describes this grove of death where African workers, just exhausted and sick, are left to die. It's this overwhelming feeling of waste, cruelty, and just profound inefficiency. Completely the opposite of any idea of a productive, civilizing project.
And this is where he meets the accountant.
Yes. Amidst all this horror, he meets the chief accountant, this impeccably dressed guy, almost absurdly clean and composed, managing to keep up appearances in the middle of utter squalor. And it's here, from this accountant, that Marlowe first hears the name of the legendary Mr. Kurtz, spoken of with this kind of awe as a prodigy in getting ivory.
That image, the pristine accountant and all that devastation, it's incredibly potent. What's Conrad doing by presenting this first glimpse of colonialism as not just brutal, but so absurd and wasteful?
It's a masterstroke, really. He uses that stark contrast to just immediately shatter any illusions Marlowe or, you know, us, the reader, might have had about the civilizing mission.
It's not just cruel, it's pointless.
Exactly. It's a critique of the deep moral vacuum at the heart of it all. The absurdity of a man carefully doing his books while people are dying just outside, or pointless explosions shaking the ground. It speaks to this fundamental disconnect from humanity. The accountant isn't necessarily evil, maybe, but he embodies this willful blindness, this dedication to meaningless order that just symbolizes Europe's ability to ignore the horror it creates for profit. It tells us right from this first look that the so-called civilizing mission was actually this devastatingly brutal reality of imperialism, devoid of any real human concern.
That moral vacuum feels almost tangible. It sets the stage for Marlowe's deeper psychological journey, doesn't it? So how does his journey continue upriver? What else does he find out about the colonial project and maybe about himself?
While his journey upriver is slow, agonizing, really, he gets to the central station only to find his steamboat's been sabotaged. It's sunk.
Great. More delays.
Months of delays. He's stuck there, frustrated, waiting for repairs, surrounded by all the petty scheming and hollow ambitions of the general manager.
The manager.
Yeah, this guy whose only real skill seems to be survival and making everyone feel vaguely uneasy. And he's clearly jealous of Kurtz, which only makes Marlowe more curious about this Kurtz fellow.
Right.
Finally, the trip up the winding Congo River begins. And it's surreal. It's like passing into this ancient, dense, silent jungle. He feels like he's traveling in the night of first ages. The wilderness itself feels like this active, menacing, almost conscious thing.
Wow.
Then there's this eerie, sudden attack on the steamboat. It culminates in the death of Marlowe's African helmsman. And in that moment, we see Marlowe's deep, unexpected grief. It shows he still has this capacity for real human connection, despite the dehumanizing world he's in.
That sounds like a really transformative part of the story, the river journey itself.
Mm.
It feels like more than just travel, right?
Yeah.
How does Conrad use this trip upriver to deepen Marlowe's psychological descent and his critique of the Europeans?
Oh, the river journey is hugely symbolic. It's less a straight path and more like an umbilical cord pulling Marlowe deeper and deeper into the primal, untamed heart of the continent. And it mirrors his journey inwards into the depths of human nature.
So as he goes deeper physically,
the civilized ideas he brought with him start to unravel. And what's really striking here is how he observes the cannibals on his boat.
Cannibals?
Yeah, the African crew members. Marlowe notes their incredible self-restraint, their dignity, especially when they're facing starvation, and he contrasts that sharply with the civilized Europeans who are just driven by greed and petty jealousies.
Interesting inversion there.
It's a crucial hint early on about how fragile civilization really is. It suggests the darkness isn't inherent to a place or a people, but it's a potential within everyone. And all the delays, the petty plotting among the company men, the pilgrims, as he calls them.
Right.
It just highlights this theme of the hollow men of colonialism. It shows the corruption of power, the lack of real purpose.
This gradual unraveling builds such incredible anticipation for Kurtz himself. So what finally happens when Marlowe gets to the inner station? What does he find out about the man he's been searching for so intensely?
Well, the climax of the journey, it's both horrifying and revealing. Deep in the interior, Marlowe finds the Russian trader, this devoted, almost childlike follower of Kurtz, dressed in these brightly patched sort of harlequin clothes.
The harlequin, right.
Yeah. And this guy provides crucial information. He reveals how Kurtz transformed from this zealous European idealist into a kind of godlike figure among the local people, conducting raids, mysterious rituals, hinting at really unspeakable things.
Oh, wow.
But nothing really prepares Marlowe or us for the inner station itself. The sight is shocking. Severed human heads stuck on posts around the station.
Some posts.
Yes. A stark, barbaric testament to Kurtz's methods, his complete fall into savagery.
Hey.
And the meeting with Kurtz himself, when it finally happens, physically, it's almost anticlimactic. He's dying, skeletal. But his voice still has immense hypnotic power. And then there's the presence of the African woman, Kurtz's mistress. Powerful, enigmatic, a figure of striking dignity and kind of wild beauty.
The imagery of those heads is just chilling. A symbol of that unchecked power. From your perspective, how does Conrad make Kurtz such an enigma? Someone who pushes colonialism to its darkest, maybe most philosophical extreme.
Kurtz really is the novel's great enigma, isn't he? He embodies that logical endpoint of colonial exploitation and maybe even a kind of philosophical nihilism.
Mm-hmm.
He's not just a simple villain. He's someone who arrived with high ideals, you know, supposedly wanting to bring light and knowledge.
The civilizing mission, again.
Exactly. But he completely succumbed to the absolute power he found in the wilderness. And the Russian trader's naive admiration for him is key. It highlights that seductive, dangerous power of a charismatic leader. And how being close to extreme situations can just normalize the abnormal, make barbarity seem like strength.
Mm.
And the most chilling detail, of course, is that postscript. Scrawled on his eloquent report for the International Society for the Suppression of Savage Customs, our report initially full of idealistic talk.
And the postscript says,
"Exterminate all the brutes." It reveals the ultimate transformation, the complete surrender to primal instinct. It just shows how that human capacity for darkness can emerge terrifyingly when all societal constraints are gone.
That one line, exterminate all the brutes, speaks volumes. The journey back downriver must feel profoundly different, especially with Kurtz on board. How does the story wrap up?
Mm-hmm.
And what's Marlowe's final pivotal act when he gets back to civilization?
Yeah, the descent is completed with this desperate final moment. Kurtz, even weakened, tries to escape back into the jungle.
He tries to go back.
He does, and Marlowe has to physically stop him, intercept him, pull him back from what Marlowe sees as the final abyss of his own darkness. Then Kurtz dies on the journey downriver. His last words, famous, ambiguous, The horror.
The horror.
Marlowe himself gets terribly ill afterwards. It's like a reflection of the trauma he's been through, and it establishes this strange, haunting connection with Kurtz. After he slowly recovers, he goes back to Brussels, and he visits Kurtz's fiancée, his intended. Who really represents European idealism, its blissful ignorance, its need for comforting stories. Mm-hmm. And this is where Marlowe tells his big lie. He chooses not to tell her the devastating truth about Kurtz's last words.
What does he tell her?
He tells her Kurtz's last word was her name.
Wow. Protecting her from the horror.
Exactly.
The ambiguity of the horror, or the horror, mm-hmm. has always fascinated people. Mm-hmm. What are some ways people interpret that? And how does Marlowe's deliberate lie change how we think about truth, illusion, and maybe society's survival?
Well, the interpretations of the horror are just endless, aren't they? It's one of literature's most iconic lines. Mm-hmm. It's Kurtz judging his own monstrous acts, a condemnation of all humanity, an existential scream against meaninglessness.
So many possibilities.
For Marlowe, it seems like Kurtz achieved some kind of moral victory in that final self-knowledge. Kurtz, at least, saw something in the end. But Marlowe's lie to the intended, that's maybe even more profound.
Why do you say that?
Because it shows him recognizing that some truths are just too dark. Too destructive for society, or at least for someone like the intended, to handle. He's protecting the comfortable illusions that make civilized life seem possible, shielding her from a truth that would just shatter her world, and by extension, maybe the fragile basis of European society itself.
So he carries the burden of that truth.
He does. He returns to Europe haunted, unable to really fit back into a society that seems blind to the realities he witnessed. His choice suggests that sometimes, maybe, preserving illusion is seen as necessary for collective peace, even if it costs of the individual who knows the truth dearly.
That's a powerful and quite disturbing conclusion. It really forces you to think about the cost of our own comfortable illusions. Okay, let's try to distill some of the core themes, the lasting impressions from this incredible work. One of the most crucial takeaways for our listeners.
Well, right at the core, Heart of Darkness is just this devastating critique of the hypocrisy of imperialism. Conrad powerfully shows how that high-minded civilizing mission was really just a thin cover for brutal economic exploitation.
The light brought darkness.
Exactly. European claims of bringing light ultimately plunge them into moral darkness. It reveals the destructive heart of unchecked greed and power.
And beyond the political, it's also deeply psychological, isn't it?
Oh, absolutely. It digs deep into the frailty of civilization and the darkness of the human heart. Through Kurtz's terrifying fall, Conrad shows that maybe moral behavior often depends on external rules, societal structures, not necessarily inherent goodness.
Take away the rule.
Take away the rules, the restraints, and the inner darkness can emerge with, well, astonishing force. The jungle, in that sense, just provides the setting for Kurtz's inner emptiness to take over.
Which brings us back to Marlowe's own struggle throughout the narrative.
Indeed. A huge theme is the inability to communicate truth. Marlowe constantly struggles, doesn't he? He tries to explain the frankly unspeakable reality of what he saw to his listeners back in Europe. He often says they just can't understand.
And the lie to the intended is the ultimate example of that.
It really is. It underlines how impossible it is to fully share such a profound, soul-changing truth. And Conrad's style, his impressionistic style, the heavy use of symbolism, the river darkness versus light, the ivory itself is this corrupting force.
Mm-hmm.
All that is crucial in creating the novel's incredibly powerful atmosphere, its layers of meaning. It makes us feel Marlowe's moral confusion, that profound unease. And his irony is everywhere, constantly undercutting the official talk of colonialism, exposing the rot at the core. It reminds us, you know, appearances can be very deceiving.
So it's really not just a story about the past or some far-off place. It feels incredibly relevant, even now.
It really is. It's like a timeless mirror reflecting our own potential for both understanding and judgment, and the fragility maybe of our own societal veneers. It forces us to face uncomfortable questions without giving easy answers. It echoes through history and even in contemporary talks about power, exploitation, and the human mind.
Heart of Darkness remains essential, I think, because it takes a specific historical critique and turns it into this universal exploration of moral complexity, of human nature itself.
Absolutely. It forces us to look past the comforting illusions and really confront the difficult, often terrifying truths about society, about history, and about the darkness that perhaps can reside within the human heart.
This conversation ends here. We'll meet again with another unique work of world literature. This audio summary is brought to you by the Katra Foundation.